From The Recount, I'm Rena Ninen, and you're listening to The Recount Daily Pod. Today's Monday, August 31st.
One thing that people glom onto misinformation is that misinformation tends to be edgier. It has an element of surprise. It has an element of conspiracy and scandal.
That was Bhaskar Chakravorty, Dean of Global Business at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, talking about how misinformation spreads on social media and who is most susceptible. We're going to dig into that a little bit later on, but first, your morning headlines. We start in Louisiana, where Hurricane Ida made landfall yesterday, making it the most intense hurricane on record to hit the state. By Sunday afternoon, over 400,000 people were without power. Utility companies warned that these outages could last for weeks. President Joe Biden spoke from FEMA headquarters, promising to put the country's full weight behind rescue and recovery efforts. He also signed an emergency declaration for Louisiana and Mississippi in advance to ensure swift aid for recovery. Worries that Hurricane Ida could worsen the healthcare crisis already besieged by coronavirus were heightened as Dr. Fauci spoke on CNN's State of the Union.
We're having a situation where even when you're stressed to the limit, to superimpose upon it what will likely be a historic weather environmental catastrophe is going to do nothing but make things much, much worse.
With the state becoming an epicenter, infections, hospitalizations, and deaths have reached their highest levels of the pandemic just in this month. Hospitals are so strained that Governor John Bel Edwards said evacuating them isn't possible because there's nowhere else with capacity to take them. Next to Kabul, where after a weekend filled with violence, the U.S. continues its evacuation efforts, it's down to the wire. Just one day left until President Biden's withdrawal deadline. According to Central Command, the U.S. carried out a drone strike on an explosive-laden vehicle. The vehicle was likely intended to target Kabul airport. Three children were reportedly killed in the strike. The U.S. military has been conducting more targeted attacks after Thursday's airport suicide bombing, which killed 175, including 13 U.S. soldiers. Al Jazeera reports that the Taliban have been struggling to keep the increased threat of ISIL at bay with an over-reliance on American intel and power. The biggest worry for many is what will happen to the country once American and NATO forces leave. Now to COVID and the rampant misinformation that's led many to take an anti-parasite horse drug, which is not at all effective and is in fact very dangerous. Dr. Anthony Fauci has one simple word of advice. Don't.
Don't do it. There's no evidence whatsoever that that works and it could potentially have toxicity. There's no clinical evidence that indicates that this works.
If you're wondering why he's putting out that warning, pharmaceuticals have seen a 24-fold increase in ivermectin prescriptions. To put things in perspective, between the years of 2019 and 2020, the U.S. averaged 3,600 prescriptions a week for that drug. The week of August 13th, there were 88,000. Poison control centers across the country have seen a massive increase in calls. Many include people who have bought the drug without a prescription, including formulas meant for large animals. The CDC warned that those doses are highly concentrated and can result in an overdose. Misinformation on social media has been rampant since the pandemic set in 18 months ago. There have been some very real and in some cases dire consequences. But some people are more vulnerable than others. Why? And what can be done to keep people safe? I dig into that today with my guest, Bhaskar Chakravorty, Dean of Global Business at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, on today's Daily Deep Dive. Dr. Chakravorty, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rena.
So, Dr. Chakravorty, you began your focus during the presidential election last year looking into misinformation, but you were able to take that and extrapolate it when you were looking at skyrocketing COVID cases and vaccine rates. What did you learn?
Obviously, we are all subject to misinformation because we are spending so much time on screen. No matter who we are, where we are subject to a mix of reliable and unreliable information. But what we did learn was that there are significant differences in terms of people's vulnerability to being misinformed. And that varies depending on how old you are, how much education you've had, which networks you're a part of, you know, digitally and in real life. And also, you know, something as simple as, do I get my information on my phone while I'm walking from one place to another, or am I standing or sitting at a desk and reading it on a laptop? So misinformation washes over us in many, many different ways and through multiple media.
You mapped out misinformation vulnerability state by state. What did you find when you looked across America when it came to COVID and vaccine?
Well, what we found was age and the lack of formal education almost directly correlates with a higher propensity to being misinformed. There's an additional factor that plays a big role, which is your political leanings. If you're further to the extreme ends of the political spectrum, you tend to be more vulnerable to misinformation. And finally, it also depends on how you get your information. If you rely primarily on social media, you're likely to be more, you know, misinformed.
What areas of the U.S. are most susceptible to misinformation, and why do you think that is?
Well, the areas that we found to be most susceptible are certain states like Florida, Montana, South Dakota, Wisconsin, states like Mississippi, Tennessee, New Mexico, Oklahoma. These were all very high in terms of vulnerability. We also found states like Ohio and Pennsylvania a bit of a mix. And the interesting things about these states are that they're a combination of demographic factors and education factors that play a role, but there's also politics. So many of these states, for example, Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, they are swing states, heavily contested, and both political parties want their favor and want their support. So there's a barrage of misinformation that often is the front end of the political engine that's targeted at the people in these states.
We know how states rank. Is there a correlation, misinformation and low vaccine rates?
Yes, there is a correlation. Once you control for age, there definitely is a very strong correlation between being misinformed and also being behind in terms of vaccination status.
What makes people glom on to misinformation? Can you identify the type? Can you identify who's more susceptible?
Yeah, one thing that people glom on to misinformation is that misinformation tends to be edgier. It has an element of surprise. It has an element of conspiracy and scandal. It has an element of making me want to share it with others because, you know, gee, did you hear that this was a virus that was developed in a government lab somewhere? Or, you know, the United States government is now rushing through a vaccine that is not fully approved. So some people have died. It's much more interesting to click on that kind of content because I want to learn more. And at the moment I've seen a little bit of it, instantly want to share it with others because it gives me almost a degree of credibility with my friends and my connections. I'm among the first to have kind of got this piece of breaking news. So it gives me a dopamine rush. Data-based, evidence-based information, which tends to have a bit of a, on the one hand, this, on the other hand, that. Yes, the vaccine is effective. However, that doesn't mean that you can't get the infection. That's kind of a complicated message. It is not edgy. It takes time to explain. It takes time to understand. And of course, misinformation comes in a variety of forms. There's some misinformation that has a kernel of truth in it. And so that tends to give it a sense of credibility. And then there is misinformation, which sadly also carries quite a bit, which is just absolutely crazy stuff. And I shared with enough people that some percentage of them will believe it.
What can the White House do that could make a difference in cracking down on misinformation?
So in many ways, I can understand the administration being frustrated by plateauing of the vaccination rates. And no question about it, misinformation has played a role in that slowdown. But then to pick a fight with Facebook, it just seems counterproductive.
Facebook said they've removed over 20 million pieces of content that has misinformation since the start of the pandemic through the summer. But a lot of people say they're not doing enough. This company has tons of money and resources. But you say they're not the villain in this. Why?
So I wouldn't say they are doing enough. They can certainly do more. No question about it. What Facebook could have done is they could have done that analysis of who were the most influential misinformers on their own much faster and much earlier. And then they could have gone after that disinformation dozen and checked every single message that those people put out and essentially blocked them or deprioritized them. So Facebook is always behind the ball. The other issue is that we're constantly addressing this problem on the supply side. What can Facebook do? What can we do in silencing the Florida doctor who seems to be number one on the disinformation dozen? Absolutely, we should go after the supply side. But we should also be thinking about the demand side. Let's think about where the vulnerabilities are. Who are the people who are most likely to be targeted? And then create a campaign that is more local. People tend to trust people who are closer to them. So it's not just Joe Biden, a disembodied voice and a face in the distance, or somebody sending me a message over a Facebook post. I tend to trust a post if it's coming to me from a friend, somebody in my social networks. So we need to be able to infiltrate those local, the very local nature of how information travels, and then be able to develop an education and a re-education campaign. And that is hard work. And that's the kind of work that's done in election campaigns. People win elections by going almost door to door and then changing people's minds, getting out the vote. Doing that kind of initiative takes a lot of hard work, and it's blood, sweat, and tears, and it's shoe leather work. We haven't done that.
And I just want to make clear to folks, if you're not familiar with the disinformation does, initially this group was identified in March by the nonprofit Center for Countering Digital Hate. This organization found that 12 people were responsible for 65% of COVID misinformation on Facebook. So that's the group that you're referring to. I want to ask you a little bit in this moment. So much in the news is about Afghanistan. And I want to ask you about the Taliban. There's a big push now to shut down the Taliban on social media, on all sorts of platforms. Do you think that's a good idea to just shut down organizations like that?
I certainly think there is some merit to considering shutting down an organization that has the terrifying history of the Taliban. However, I think it's a bad idea to shut down, to deplatform the Taliban right now.
Why do you feel like we should not?
So here's my argument. The Taliban right now are effectively the administration in Afghanistan. They may not be the recognized government, but eventually they will be the administration. Now, imagine the scenario where the Taliban, you know, whoever is the presumptive leader, if it's Abdul Ghani Baradar, who's the co-founder of the Taliban, if he becomes the new leader, he does not have a Facebook page because Facebook has deplatformed him. So Baradar says, I don't have a Facebook page. Well, neither does anybody else in Afghanistan. Why should I not be able to tell my side of the story? And some poor Afghan who is suffering has covertly opened up their Facebook page and they're broadcasting video about their suffering. I'm certainly not going to allow that. Now, what does that mean? The only way in which we can get news out of Afghanistan from here on out are ordinary people with their smartphones taking video of their lives on their route to the airport, on at the airport and everywhere else, and posting that on social media. If that is shut down, we have no more news out of Afghanistan. And by the way, dissident groups who might want to put up some kind of an opposition to the Taliban, they get shut down because of the same reasons. In the meantime, Baradar's Facebook page is blocked because Facebook has taken the easy route by saying blocking the Taliban. However, the Taliban are operating on Facebook. They're operating on WhatsApp. They are all over the place because they're opening new accounts on a minute-by-minute basis. So they are getting their message through. These are techniques that are tried and tested by terror groups, by the Mexican drug cartels. They have always been able to break through the Facebook filter. So you end up with an ineffective policy where the people whose voices we all need to hear outside Afghanistan, that gets crushed. And the propaganda of the Taliban will make its way through these filters. If it's not Facebook, they will come through WhatsApp, which is end-to-end encrypted, so Facebook can't really stop it, or it'll come through Twitter or Telegram. So I think it's a bad policy. I do have one more point to add to this, Reena. Now, if my recommendation would be to let the Taliban back on Facebook, but then Facebook has to do the hard work of monitoring that content and seeing if it violates community standards, if it violates international human rights standards, if it violates a variety of different principles that we agree to as a global society. And the moment it does that, it flags it, it takes it off the platform, it deprioritizes it, kills it, whatever that needs to be done. But that means Facebook has to do the hard work. And here, basically what they've done is they've just said, oh, we've banned the Taliban, we've done our job, don't blame us for this. That's not acceptable. Right now, Facebook has become the de facto ears and eyes on the ground. They've become de facto U.S. intelligence. Last 20 years has shown that the U.S. intelligence hasn't been great. We're just going to add to that calamity by Facebook executives becoming the de facto State Department, which should be unacceptable. They're not elected or they're not been appointed to that role.
We've got to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with Dr. Bhaskar Chakravarthy, Dean of Global Business at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, on the Recount Daily Pod. Welcome back to the Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from the Recount and iHeartRadio. I'm joined by Dr. Bhaskar Chakravarthy, who's the Dean of Global Business at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. And we're talking about how misinformation spreads. So stepping back, as you look into COVID and vaccination rates, where are you taking your research and what are you looking for, especially as we head into midterms?
Well, the research that we do, Rena, is covering a wide variety of issues, ranging from not just misinformation, but issues of trust. How do we even use technology in different applications across the United States and across 90 countries around the world? Where we're taking this right now is we're trying to paint a picture not only in terms of how divided we are about the information that we receive over the internet, but also how divided we are in terms of just access to the internet. What is shocking to me is that the United States government and its critical agencies, which includes the Federal Communications Commission, the White House, and members of Congress, do not have accurate data on how many Americans are not using the internet at speeds that would allow the kind of video conversation that you and I are having. In other words, they don't have access to broadband. The FCC under the Trump administration deliberately gave an underestimate of the number of Americans who are not connected to broadband. An independent research group did a study, and they found that the number of people who are not connected to broadband is at least twice that number. According to Microsoft, which actually has equipment in the field, they say that it's not twice the number, it's eight times the number of Americans who are not using the internet at broadband speeds. In other words, half the country is not using the internet at broadband speeds, which means half the country cannot have their children at home and be able to attend a classroom. Half the country cannot join a Zoom call if they're working remotely. Half the country can't do an interview because they've been laid off in their previous jobs and they're now trying to get a new job. So these are all now serious issues post-pandemic. So where we're spending a lot of time is trying to paint a very clear picture in terms of the digital divide, access to information, affordability of that access, and how people are using it. And then there's one more step, which is as we use the internet, whether it's on our phones or on our computers, every time we even move our phone from this point to that point, I'm generating this thing called data. I'm generating a very valuable resource, enormously so valuable that companies essentially give me services for free so that I can give them data in exchange. That data is then going to feed a whole bunch of algorithms, which will then shape tomorrow's products and services. So if my digital access is skewed, if people who are black and brown have much lower degrees of access to the internet, then their data is not going to be used in those algorithms. So today's discrimination against people who are lower down in the socioeconomic ladder, people of color, women rather than men, who all are disadvantaged in terms of their use of the internet and the submission of data to those algorithms, those elements of discrimination gets magnified and multiplied and solidified into the future. Those are the kinds of issues that we are studying and we are trying to analyze and we are trying to raise awareness of them.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Chakravarthy, for joining us.
Sure. Thank you for having me, Rena. I enjoyed it.
And now to the look ahead. Here's what else we're watching today. In tennis, the U.S. Open begins in Queens today, with Serena Williams dropping out due to a torn hamstring. All eyes will be on returning champion Naomi Osaka. The number two ranked player in the world was recently knocked out of the Olympics after the third round. Naomi, who has struggled with mental health, wrote on social media about being mentally prepared for the game, saying, quote, "Your life is your own, and you should value yourself on other people's standards. I know I give my heart to everything I can, and if that's not good enough for some, then my apologies, but I can't burden myself with those expectations anymore." 54 years today, the Senate approved the appointment of American lawyer and civil rights activist Thurgood Marshall to the Supreme Court, making him the first African-American to serve. He was most known for the case Brown versus Board of Education, where the Supreme Court ruled that separate but equal was not applicable to public education because it could never be truly equal. We leave you with Thurgood Marshall talking about racism.
A recent survey shows that racism is broader and stronger than before. We're not gaining ground, my friends. We might be losing. But one thing I'm sure of is there's no time to stop.
Have a great day. This is the Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from The Recount and iHeartRadio. Our thanks to Bhaskar Chakravorty for being on the show. And if you like this episode, I hope you'll subscribe to The Recount Daily Pod and leave a rating on the Apple Podcast app. I'm your host, Rena Ninen.